When you think of a novel of manners, Jane Austen probably comes to mind. But Helen Simonson, author of her own novel of manners, Major Pettigrew's Last Stand, says, "Not so fast." In our series, Three Books, in which authors recommend three books on one theme, she recommends three books about manners not written by Miss Austen.
Over the centuries, novels of manners, with their wit and acute observation, have always illustrated people behaving badly. A quick flip through today's celebrity magazines will prove that century to century, nothing changes. The social climbers, the gossips, the ruthless acquiring of a suitably endowed spouse, all are as relevant and as fascinating today as in Jane Austen's portraits of small English villages. Beyond Jane Austen, the true master, here are three of my favourite examples of novels of manners. Undine Spragg. The name says it all. In Edith Wharton's acclaimed novel, The Custom of the Country, this monster of a shallow social climber arrives from the rough commercial Midwest to reside in a Louis suite at a New York City hotel and to look for a husband. Undine's ruthless quest leads her to trade up, first through the old guard Washington Square elite and then into French nobility. Though she sacrifices a husband and her child to her ambition, no rank she achieves is quite good enough, and the novel ends with her absolute frustration in discovering that she will never be an ambassador's wife. A sharp portrait of the shifting rules of American society in the early 1900s, it is also timeless. Substitute names from today, tabloid celebrities, annoying heiresses with their own clothing lines, political appointees with a keen nose for protocol, and this book is more textbook than novel. For anyone who thrilled to the recent scandal of Oxford poets conducting smear campaigns, Cakes and Ale by Somerset Maugham is a delicious, biting satire of the lengths writers will go to advance and burnish their reputations. A famous writer and his second wife need a biographer, the catch being that the writer's beautiful, unfaithful first wife, his true muse, is to be carefully written out. The writer they choose is a complete hack, whose fine literary reputation has been built by shamelessly courting critics with expensive lunches. The book was considered a scandalous, thinly veiled portrait of Thomas Hardy, an idea Maugham slyly refuted by suggesting the names of two other writers who were equally in his mind. Writers behaving badly in wonderful country settings, more proof that nothing changes. Map and Lucia is the third title in a series of six novels by British author E.F. Benson, set mostly in Tilling, a fictionalised version of my hometown of Rye, East Sussex. The widowed Lucia, a sophisticated summer visitor, arrives to rent a house from the town's leading light, Miss Map, and to battle for control of the local social life. The fate, the art show, and control of the gardener. Nothing is too petty to fight over in a malicious war of attrition disguised as a friendly cup of tea. The redeeming hope in novels of manners is that while we laugh at the scheming and squabbles of others, we might recognise a few guilty flaws of our own. I am convinced that if we can only learn to laugh at ourselves, we may become a more civilised society. Please pass the finger sandwiches.
Helen Simonson is the author of Major Pettigrew's Last Stand. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
March Madness continues tomorrow as the NCAA college basketball tournament moves into the Sweet 16. The one big city that has no big-time team is New York, and that's got commentator Frank DeFord wondering, what's with the Big Apple?
As the NCAA tournament heads toward the regionals, as the NBA bides its time until the playoff push begins, that is, as basketball rules the day, it's ironic that New York, the city where the game really gained popularity at Madison Square Garden, has never been more of a basketball laughingstock. Why, if Damon Runyon was eating cheesecake at Lindy's today, this is what he'd be saying. It is a pretty pass indeed, when, as it is indisputably known to all guys and not a few dames, that it is here that the hardwood game first flowered. But we have now not one team of quality, and I give you 6-5 that our fabled garden is itself full of weeds. Ah, the Garden, the place where college basketball first took an urban foothold, starting in 1934 when a promoter named Ned Irish began scheduling college doubleheaders. New York teams like NYU, St. John's, Long Island University, CCNY packed the joint and were the powers in the sport. Every team in the country wanted to play there, as sure as every Shantuzzi wanted to sing at the Copa. Then when the NBA got going, sure, the Knickerbockers may have often been bums, but now there were pro doubleheaders. For the guys wearing satin shorts, it was their Broadway. And in fact, the Garden was invariably referred to as the Mecca of basketball. Today, deferentially, the teams that come into the Garden still profess to swoon at working Mecca, but it's merely being polite, like asking for an autograph from some old faded movie star. Because the fact is now that every city of any size and most big-time colleges possess basketball cathedrals every bit as impressive. After all, arenas and stadiums are what pass nowadays for American infrastructure. The Garden in New York live off basketball memories. Not a single New York area team even got a whiff of the NCAAs. Not only that, but the Knicks have been toxic waste for years, and across the river, the Nets are striving manfully to put up the worst record in NBA history. Not only that, but to add to the Big Apple's basketball disgrace, the upstate of New York, which for the city's sporting types is historically only consisted of the Saratoga racetrack, not only produced a number one seed in Syracuse, but also in the regionals it has Cornell. Cornell from the Ivy League. Cornell from far above Cayuga's waters. Whatever. Syracuse and Cornell. And there in New York City, a basketball vacuum. It's like they took all the kangaroos out of Australia.
The comments of Frank DeFord, senior contributing writer at Sports Illustrated. This week's issue includes a memoir of his early days at the magazine. Frank joins us Wednesdays from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
This week we've been hearing how states are funding their public pension plans. Today, why Illinois is the worst in the nation when it comes to setting aside enough money for state workers and retirees. Illinois has socked away less than half the money that's been promised for public pensions, and that big gap keeps growing. NPR's David Shaper wraps up our series with this report.
Illinois has five public pension funds for teachers, state employees, university employees, judges, and legislators. Think of them as one big home mortgage. And instead of making the required house payments, Illinois' governors and state lawmakers have been paying much less than they should, even skipping some payments and borrowing money to make others.
Basically, the state of Illinois is upside down on its home mortgage, and it's maxed out its credit cards, and it's applying for more credit cards.
Lawrence Massal is president of the Chicago-based Civic Federation, which keeps tabs on government finances. He says Illinois has so badly underfunded its pensions that the unfunded liability has ballooned to a whopping $78 billion.
That means every man, woman, and child in the state of Illinois is on the hook for $6,031 of pension promises that we don't have the assets for.
Ms. Saul and others say Illinois' pension deficit has exploded in recent years because the state's politicians have used budget gimmicks. They've taken pension holidays and they've borrowed heavily. Just this January, Illinois issued $3.5 billion in pension obligation bonds to make this year's pension payment. So the state has to begin paying that borrowed money back next year to the tune of $800 million. Illinois' bond rating is now lower than any other state's except California's, so it pays high interest rates. And if its bond rating goes any lower, Illinois soon may not be able to borrow money at all. Eden Martin is president of the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago, a business group. He says while the politicians have been underfunding Illinois' pensions, they've also sweetened pension benefits.
For example, in Illinois, if you're a state employee, you can retire at either 60 or 55, depending on which pension plan you're in, with a full pension if you have enough years in the pension system. That's pretty early.
Martin says early retirement incentives over the years have thousands more retirees drawing pension checks for longer periods of time. He adds that Illinois retirees get automatic 3% annual pay increases, regardless of the rate of inflation, and the state pays their health insurance premium.
The pensions have become, with the passage of time, more generous, out of sync with what's going on in the private sector, and that's where reform has to happen.
Martin's group and others are pushing for Illinois to raise the retirement age and to implement a two-tiered retirement system so future state employees would be on a defined contribution plan instead of the defined benefit system in place now. Illinois' Constitution prohibits a reduction in benefits earned by current retirees and employees. And many of those retirees say they're hardly living high on the hog as has been portrayed.
Okay, this is my living room. As you see, there's nothing fancy in here.
70-year-old Ida Calloway shows off her modest three-bedroom ranch home in Chicago's south suburbs. Calloway worked for the state for 24 years as a mental health technician, bathing, dressing, and feeding people with developmental disabilities in a state home.
There were some who couldn't walk, couldn't feed themselves. I know I had to learn how to massage food down their throat. It was hard. You get feces thrown on you. You get spit on.
Calloway says she deserves every penny of her $1,473 a month pension, and she doesn't think it's fair to reduce benefits for current and future state employees who do this kind of work. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Illinois' pension benefits are on or below par with other states. The union's Hank Sheff says employees contribute at least 4% of their pre-tax salary into the pension funds, and he argues they shouldn't be asked to give up benefits or pay more.
I mean, if the problem was created by underfunding, the solution is funding.
Current and retired state workers were among the groups rallying at the Illinois Capitol earlier this month for a big tax increase to, in part, better fund the pension plans. They're a potent political force, which makes lawmakers queasy about reducing benefits and raising taxes in this election year. But the experts say kicking the can down the road, as Illinois has done so many times before, only moves this state's pension funds closer to the brink of going broke within the next decade. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
You can hear more stories in our series Deferred Promises, America's Pension Crisis, at our website, npr.org.
Health insurance companies stand to pick up more than 20 million new customers as the new health care legislation takes effect. But that doesn't mean that the industry is altogether thrilled, and in fact, there's been quite a bit of grumbling. David Cordani is president and CEO of one of the nation's largest health insurers, Cigna, and he joins us from his offices in Philadelphia. Welcome to the program, Mr. Cordani.
Good to be with you today. Thank you.
And the first question that many people are asking is, will my premiums go up? And in the interest of full disclosure, some of those people are NPR employees because Cigna coverage is offered here. Will their premiums go up?
Over the near term in the employer marketplace, premiums will probably go up somewhat over the near term. Some of the aspects of the current legislation will actually put cost pressure over the next several years as some of the fees and levies that are passed through to the industry begin to unfold. For employers, though, there's a significant number of employers that use a lot of innovative programs with us around health improvement, productivity improvement, wellness that offset some of those increases. So it depends on the employer's programs currently as to whether or not they will increase and how much so.
But you're saying that as there are fees that are paid by the insurance companies and such, you'll just pass those along to policyholders. So that's one reason that prices will go up over the years?
I'll cite two. That's one, and specifically the CBO's estimate assessed that the fees on the industry would indeed be passed through to individuals and employers, and that was their assumption. In addition, as the Medicaid programs grow, there's a natural cost shifting from Medicaid reimbursement to physicians to the commercial system for employers and individuals to pay for.
Let me ask you a question that that some people are remarking on, and the president has alluded to this. Cigna's profits rose 7% last year. You had more than $18 billion in revenue. Your predecessor left with a $110 million retirement package. It sounds like it's a profitable enough company to absorb some of the fees that will be added to your business by this bill.
The healthcare business, so for our company or for the industry, but specifically if we stay with Cigna, our healthcare businesses had a profit margin of about 2%, and that's been consistent over the last 5 years. We've worked with a lot of disclosures with the government. So it's a thin margin business on an after-tax basis. A final way of looking at it is you could take the profits of the entire healthcare industry, and that will pay for healthcare for Americans for about 2 days. So the challenge is, what do we do for the other 360-plus days of the year to be able to pay for that?
Mr. Cordani, when you next report to Cigna's shareholders, or to the board for that matter, what's the word? A law has been passed, and now we're going to work with it, and it's the future, or a disaster has just happened in Washington, it's calamitous for our business? What's the line here?
We look at our corporation as a global health service company, so we have services outside the U.S. as well as inside the U.S. The broad level of services we offer are primarily to employers around health improvement, wellness improvement, productivity improvement, et cetera. So for that focus of our business, we actually see it as having significant opportunity both in the United States as well as outside of the United States.
Would Cigna welcome a trade association that it belongs to, or any other lobby that represents it, to actively work for the repeal of provisions of this act?
I don't believe focusing on repeal right now is in anybody's best interest. I believe focusing on the next leg of the stool as rapidly as possible is critical, which is to drive sustainability to cost. That's what the focus needs to be on, as opposed to trying to repeal what's already been done and the country spent the year on.
So just to make sure, you're saying it doesn't make sense to you to work for repeal right now, but to continue working for cost containment in some way. Given what the country has just been through to get the bill that was signed into law today, can you imagine another big health care bill that would address health care costs actually going through Congress anytime soon?
I guess the question is time. So go back and look at the Massachusetts model. Massachusetts model has been operating for 2 to 3 years and is now at the brink of bankruptcy and has to deal with the cost equation. So you could view that as an outer limit, as an indication of what will probably transpire at a federal level.
So you think around 2013, 2014, we have an appointment with another big healthcare bill, is what you're saying?
And ideally, that's correct. And ideally with some smaller steps along the way. So we're not waiting for one big fell swoop, but we could actually build upon what has been enacted.
Well, Mr. Cordani, I hope we can check in with you in the coming months as we see what the impact of this health care law is on the country and on your business.
I would look forward to that as well.
Great. That's David Cordani, who joined us from Cigna's corporate headquarters in Philadelphia. He is the president and CEO of Cigna.